Your old or broken phone can let you down when you need it most.
Perfect.
But at Verizon, trade in any old phone from our top brands and get the most for it. Up to $2,000 in value for an amazing new iPhone 16 Pro with Apple Intelligence and a new line on my plan. And iPad and Apple Watch Series 10. That's like a 3-for-1. And you can get it on any plan. At Verizon, trade in your old phone for a brand new iPhone 16 Pro, iPad, and Apple Watch. The other guys won't give you that. Visit Verizon.com today. Additional terms apply. Service plan required for Apple Watch and iPad. Up to $2,000 value based on iPhone, iPad, and Apple Watch.
Chapter 10 of Rupert of Hentzau. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please go to LibriVox.org. Recording by Andy Minter. Rupert of Hentzau, taken from the memoirs of Fritz von Tarlenheim, by Anthony Hope. Chapter 10. The King in Strelsau. Mr. Rassendyll reached Strelsau from Zenda without accident about 9 in the evening of the same day as that which witnessed the tragedy of the hunting lodge. He could have arrived sooner, but prudence did not allow him to enter the populous suburbs of the town till darkness guarded him from notice. The gates of the city were no longer shut at sunset as they used to be in the days when Duke Michael was governor, and Rudolf passed them without difficulty. Fortunately, the night, fine where we were, was wet and stormy at Strelsau. Thus there were few people in the streets, and he was able to gain the door of my house, still unremarked. Here, of course, a danger presented itself. None of my servants were in the secret, only my wife, in whom the Queen herself had confided, knew Rudolf, and she did not expect to see him, since she was ignorant of the recent course of events. Rudolf was quite alive to the peril, and regretted the absence of his faithful attendant, who could have cleared the way for him. The pouring rain gave him an excuse for twisting a scarf about his face and pulling his coat collar up to his ears, while the gusts of wind made the cramming of his hat low down over his eyes no more than a natural precaution against its loss. Thus masked from curious eyes, he drew rein before my door, and having dismounted, rang the bell. When the butler came, a strange hoarse voice, half stifled by folds of scarf, asked for the Countess, alleging for pretext a message from myself. The man hesitated, as well he might, to leave the stranger alone with the door open and the contents of the hall at his mercy. Murmuring an apology, in case his visitor should prove to be a gentleman, he shut the door and went in search of his mistress. His description of the untimely caller at once roused my wife's quick wit. She had heard from me how Rudolf had ridden once from Strelsau to the hunting lodge with muffled face. A very tall man with his face wrapped in a scarf and his hat over his eyes, who came with a private message, suggested to her at least a possibility of Mr. Rassendyll's arrival. Helga will never admit that she is clever, yet I find she discovers from me what she wants to know, and I suspect hides successfully the small matters of which she, in her wifely discretion, deems I had best remain ignorant. Being able thus to manage me, she was equal to coping with the butler. She laid aside her embroidery most composedly. "Ah, yes," she said, "I know the gentleman. Surely you haven't left him out in the rain?" She was anxious lest Rudolf's features should have been exposed too long to the light of the hall lamps. The butler stammered an apology, explaining his fears for our goods and the impossibility of distinguishing social rank on a dark night. Helga cut him short with an impatient gesture, crying, "How stupid of you!" and herself ran quickly down and opened the door, a little way only, though. The first sight of Mr. Rassendyll confirmed her suspicions. In a moment, she said, she knew his eyes. "It is you, then," she cried, "and my foolish servant has left you in the rain. Pray come in. Oh, but your horse!" She turned to the penitent butler, who had followed her downstairs. "Take the Baron's horse round to the stables," she said. "I will send someone at once, my lady." "No, no, take it yourself. Take it at once. I'll look after the Baron." Reluctantly and ruefully, the fat fellow stepped out into the storm. Rudolf drew back and let him pass. Then he entered quickly, to find himself alone with Helga in the hall. With a finger on her lips, she led him swiftly into a small sitting-room on the ground floor, which I used as a sort of office or place of business. It looked out on the street, and the rain could be heard driving against the broad panes of the window. Rudolf turned to her with a smile, and bowing, kissed her hand. "The Baron what, my dear Countess?" he inquired. "He won't ask," said she with a shrug. "Do tell me what brings you here and what has happened." He told her, very briefly, all he knew. She hid bravely her alarm at hearing that I might perhaps meet Rupert at the lodge, and at once listened to what Rudolf wanted of her. "Can I get out of the house, and, if need be, back again unnoticed?" he asked. "The door is locked at night, and only Fritz and the butler have keys." Mr. Rassendyll's eye travelled to the window of the room. "I haven't grown so fat that I can't get through there," said he. "So we'd better not trouble the butler. He'd talk, you know." "I will sit here all night and keep everybody from the room." "I may come back pursued, if I bungle my work and an alarm is raised." "Your work?" she asked, shrinking back a little. "Yes," said he. "Don't ask what it is, Countess. It's in the Queen's service." "For the Queen I will do anything and everything, as Fritz would." He took her hand and pressed it in a friendly, encouraging way. "Then I may issue my orders?" he asked, smiling. "They shall be obeyed." "Then a dry cloak, a little supper, and this room to myself, except for you." As he spoke, the butler turned the handle of the door. My wife flew across the room, opened the door, and while Rudolf turned his back, directed the man to bring some cold meat, or whatever could be ready, with as little delay as possible. "Now, come with me," she said to Rudolf, directly the servant was gone. She took him to my dressing-room, where he got dry clothes. Then she saw the supper laid, ordered a bedroom to be prepared, told the butler that she had business with the Baron, and that he need not sit up if she were later than 11, dismissed him, and went to tell Rudolf that the coast was clear for his return to the sitting-room. He came, expressing admiration for her courage and address. I take leave to think that she deserved his compliments. He made a hasty supper. Then they talked together, Rudolf smoking his cigar. 11 came and went. It was not yet time. My wife opened the door and looked out. The hall was dark, the door locked, and its key in the hands of the butler. She closed the door again and softly locked it. As the clock struck 12, Rudolf rose and turned the lamp very low. Then he unfastened the shutters noiselessly, raised the window, and looked out. "Shut them again when I'm gone," he whispered. "If I come back, I'll knock like this, and you'll open for me." "For heaven's sake, be careful," she murmured, catching at his hand. He nodded reassuringly, and crossing his leg over the window-sill, sat there for a moment, listening. The storm was as fierce as ever, and the street was deserted. He let himself down onto the pavement, his face again wrapped up. She watched his tall figure stride quickly along till a turn of the road hid it. Then, having closed the window and the shutters again, she sat down to keep her watch, praying for him, for me, and for her dear mistress the Queen, for she knew that perilous work was afoot that night, and did not know whom it might threaten or whom destroy. From the moment that Mr. Rassendyll thus left my house at midnight, on his search for Rupert of Hentzau, every hour and almost every moment brought its incident in the swiftly moving drama which decided the issues of our fortune. What we were doing has been told. By now Rupert himself was on his way back to the city, and the Queen was meditating in her restless vigil on the resolve that in a few hours was to bring her also to Strelsau. Even in the dead of night both sides were active, for, plan cautiously and skilfully as he might, Rudolf fought with an antagonist who lost no chances, and who had found an apt and useful tool in that same Bauer, a rascal, and a cunning rascal, if ever one were bred in the world. From the beginning even to the end, our error lay in taking too little count of this fellow, and dear was the price we paid. Both to my wife and to Rudolf himself, the street had seemed empty of every living being when she watched and he set out. Yet everything had been seen, from his first arrival to the moment when she closed the window after him. At either end of my house there runs out a projection, formed by the bay windows of the principal drawing-room and of the dining-room respectively. These projecting walls form shadows. and in the shade of one of them, of which I do not know, nor is it of moment, a man watched all that passed. Had he been anywhere else, Rudolf must have seen him. If we had not been too engrossed in playing our own hands, it would doubtless have struck us as probable that Rupert would direct Rischenheim and Bauer to keep an eye on my house during his absence, for it was there that any of us who found our way to the city would naturally resort in the first instance. As a fact, he had not omitted this precaution. The night was so dark that the spy, who had seen the king but once and never Mr. Rassendyll, did not recognise who the visitor was, but he rightly conceived that he should serve his employer by tracking the steps of the tall man who made so mysterious an arrival and so surreptitious a departure from the suspected house. Accordingly, as Rudolf turned the corner and Helga closed the window, a short, thick-set figure started cautiously out of the projecting shadow and followed in Rudolf's wake through the storm. The pair, tracker and tracked, met nobody, save here and there a police constable, keeping a most unwilling beat. Even such were few, and for the most part more intent on sheltering in the lee of a friendly wall, and thereby keeping a dry stitch or two on them, than on taking note of passers-by. On the pair went. Now Rudolf turned into the Königstrasse. As he did so, Bauer, who must have been nearly 100 yards behind, for he could not start till the shutters were closed, quickened his pace, and reduced the interval between them to about 70 yards. This he might well have thought a safe distance on a night so wild, when the rush of wind and the pelt of rain joined to hide the sound of footsteps. But Bauer reasoned as a townsman, and Rudolf Rassendyll had the quick ear of a man bred in the country and trained to the woodland. All at once there was a jerk of his head. I know so well the motion which marked awakened attention in him. He did not pause nor break his stride. To do either would have been to betray his suspicions to his follower. But he crossed the road to the opposite side to that where number 19 was situated, and slackened his pace a little, so that there was a longer interval between his own footfalls. The steps behind him grew slower, even as his did. Their sound came no nearer. The follower would not overtake. Now, a man who loiters on such a night, just because another ahead of him is fool enough to loiter, has a reason for his action other than what can at first sight be detected. So thought Rudolf Rassendyll, and his brain was busied with finding it out. Then an idea seized him, and forgetting the precautions that had hitherto served so well, he came to a sudden stop on the pavement, engrossed in deep thought. Was the man who dogged his steps Rupert himself? It would be like Rupert to track him, like Rupert to conceive such an attack, like Rupert to be ready either for a fearless assault from the front or a shameless shot from behind, and indifferent utterly which chance offered, so it threw him one of them. Mr. Rassendyll asked no better than to meet his enemy thus in the open. They could fight a fair fight, and if he fell, the lamp would be caught up and carried on by Sapt's hand or mine. If he got the better of Rupert, the letter would be his. A moment would destroy it and give safety to the Queen. I do not suppose that he spent time in thinking how he should escape arrest at the hands of the police, whom the fracas would probably arouse. If he did, he may well have reckoned on declaring plainly who he was, of laughing at their surprise over a chance likeness to the king, and of trusting to us to smuggle him beyond the arm of the law. What mattered all that, so that there was a moment in which to destroy the letter? At any rate, he turned full round, and began to walk straight towards Bauer, his hand resting on the revolver in the pocket of his coat. Bauer saw him coming, and must have known that he was suspected or detected. At once the cunning fellow slouched his head between his shoulders and set out along the street at a quick shuffle, whistling as he went. Rudolf stood now in the middle of the road, wondering who the man was, whether Rupert, purposely disguising his gait, or a confederate, or after all some person innocent of our secret and indifferent to our schemes. On came Bauer, softly whistling, and slushing his feet carelessly through the liquid mud. Now he was nearly opposite where Mr. Rassendyll stood. Rudolf was well-nigh convinced that the man had been on his track. He would make certainty surer. The bold game was always his choice and his delight. This trait he shared with Rupert of Hentzau, and hence arose, I think, the strange secret inclination he had for his unscrupulous opponent. Now he walked suddenly across to Bauer and spoke to him in his natural voice, at the same time removing the scarf partly, but not altogether, from his face. "You're out late, my friend, for a night like this." Bauer, startled though he was by the unexpected challenge, had his wits about him. Whether he identified Rudolf at once, I do not know. I think that he must at least have suspected the truth. "A lad that has no home to go to must needs be out both late and early, sir," said he, arresting his shuffling steps, and looking up with that honest, stolid air which had made a fool of me. I had described him very minutely to Mr. Rassendyll. If Bauer knew or guessed who his challenger was, Mr. Rassendyll was as well equipped for the encounter. "No home to go to?" cried Rudolf in a pitying tone. "How's that? But anyhow, heaven forbid that you or any man should walk the streets a night like this. Come, I'll give you a bed. Come with me, and I'll find you good shelter, my boy." Bauer shrank away. He did not see the meaning of this stroke, and his eye, travelling up the street, showed that his thoughts had turned towards flight. Rudolf gave no time for putting any such notion into effect. Maintaining his air of genial compassion, he passed his left arm through Bauer's right, saying, "I'm a Christian man, and a bed you shall have this night, my lad, as sure as I'm alive. Come along with me. The devil, it's not weather for standing still." The carrying of arms in Strelsau was forbidden. Bauer had no wish to get into trouble with the police, and moreover he had intended nothing but a reconnaissance. He was therefore without any weapon, and he was a child in Rudolf's grasp. He had no alternative but to obey the suasion of Mr. Rassendyll's arm, and they too began to walk down the Königstrasse. Bauer's whistle had died away, not to return, but from time to time Rudolf hummed softly a cheerful tune, his fingers beating time on Bauer's captive arm. Presently they crossed the road. Bauer's lagging steps indicated that he took no pleasure in the change of side, but he could not resist. "You shall go where I am going, my lad," said Rudolf encouragingly, and he laughed a little as he looked down at the fellow's face. Along they went. Soon they came to the small numbers at the station end of the Königstrasse. Rudolf began to peer up at the shop fronts. "It's cursed dark," said he. "Pray, lad, can you make out which is 19? The moment he had spoken, the smile broadened on his face. The shot had gone home. Bauer was a clever scoundrel, but his nerves were not under perfect control, and his arm had quivered under Rudolf's.
19, sir?" he stammered.
"Aye, 19, that's where we're bound for, you and I. There I hope we shall find what we want." Bauer seemed bewildered. No doubt he was at a loss how either to understand or parry the bold attack. "Ah, this looks like it," said Rudolf, in a tone of great satisfaction, as they came to old Mother Holf's little shop. "Isn't that a 1 and a 9 over the door, my lad? Ah, and Holf! Yes, that's the name. Pray ring the bell. My hands are occupied." Rudolf's hands were indeed occupied. One held Bauer's arm, now no longer with a friendly pressure, but with a grip of iron. In the other, the captive saw the revolver that had till now lain hidden. "You see," asked Rudolf pleasantly, "you must ring for me, mustn't you? It would startle them if I roused them with a shot." A motion of the barrel told Bauer the direction which the shot would take.
"There's no bell," said Bauer sullenly.
"Ah, then you knock?"
"I suppose so."
"In any particular way, my friend?"
"I don't know," growled Bauer.
"Nor I. Can't you guess?"
"No, I know nothing of it."
"Well, we must try. You knock, and listen, my lad, you must guess right. You understand?"
"How can I guess?" asked Bauer in an attempt at bluster.
"Indeed, I don't know," smiled Rudolf, "but I hate waiting, and if the door is not open in 2 minutes, I shall arouse the good folk with a shot. You see? You quite see, don't you?" Again the barrel's motion pointed and explained Mr. Rassendyll's meaning. Under this powerful persuasion, Bauer yielded. He lifted his hand and knocked on the door with his knuckles, first loudly, then very softly, the gentler stroke being repeated 5 times in rapid succession.
Clearly he was expected, for without any sound of approaching feet, the chain was unfastened with a subdued rattle. Then came the noise of the bolt being cautiously worked back into its socket. As it shot home, a chink of the door opened. At the same moment, Rudolf's hand slipped from Bauer's arm. With a swift movement, he caught the fellow by the nape of the neck and flung him violently forward into the roadway, where, losing his footing, he fell sprawling face downward in the mud. Rudolf threw himself against the door. It yielded. He was inside, and in an instant he had shut the door and driven the bolt home again, leaving Bauer in the gutter outside. Then he turned, with his hand on the butt of his revolver. I know that he hoped to find Rupert of Hentzau's face within a foot of his. Neither Rupert nor Rischenheim, nor even the old woman, fronted him. A tall, handsome, dark girl faced him, holding an oil lamp in her hand. He did not know her, but I could have told him that she was old Mother Holf's youngest child, Rosa, for I had often seen her as I rode through the town of Zenda with the king, before the old lady moved her dwelling to Strelsau. Indeed, the girl had seemed to haunt the king's footsteps, and he had himself joked on her obvious efforts to attract his attention, and the languishing glances of her great black eyes. But it is the lot of prominent personages to inspire these strange passions, and the king had spent as little thought on her as on any of the romantic girls who found a naughty delight in half-fanciful devotion to him, devotion starting, in many cases, by an irony of which the king was happily unconscious, from the brave figure that he made at his coronation, and his picturesque daring in the affair of Black Michael. The worshippers never came near enough to perceive the alteration in their idol. The half, then, at least, of Rosa's attachment was justly due to the man who now stood opposite to her, looking at her with surprise by the murky light of the strong-smelling oil lamp. The lamp shook, and almost fell from her hand when she saw him, for the scarf had slid away, and his features were exposed to full view. Fright, delight, and excitement vied with one another in her eyes. "The king!" she whispered in amazement. "No, but—" and she searched his face wonderingly. "Is it the beard you miss?" asked Rudolf, fingering his chin. "Mayn't kings shave when they please, as well as other men?" Her face still expressed bewilderment, and still a lingering doubt. He bent towards her, whispering, "Perhaps I wasn't over-anxious to be known at once." She flushed with pleasure at the confidence he seemed to put in her. "I should know you anywhere," she whispered, with a glance at the great black eyes. "Anywhere, Your Majesty." "Then you'll help me, perhaps?" "With my life." "No, no, my dear young lady, merely with a little information. Whose home is this?"
"My mother's."
"Ah, she takes lodgers?" The girl appeared vexed at his cautious approaches.
"Tell me what you want to know," she said simply.
"Then who's here?"
"My lord the Count of Lutzau-Rischenheim."
"And what's he doing?"
"He's lying on the bed, moaning and swearing, because his wounded arm gives him pain."
"And is nobody else here?" She looked round warily, and sank her voice to a whisper as she answered,
"No, not now. Nobody else."
"I was seeking a friend of mine," said Rudolf. "I want to see him alone. It's not easy for a king to see people alone."
"You mean—"
"Well, you know who I mean."
"Yes. No, he's gone, but he's gone to find you."
"To find me? Plague take it. How do you know that, my pretty lady?"
"Bauer told me."
"Ah, Bauer. And who's Bauer?"
"The man who knocked. Why did you shut him out?"
"To be alone with you, to be sure. So, Bauer tells you his master's secrets." She acknowledged his raillery with a coquettish laugh. It was not amiss for the king to see that she had her admirers. "Well, and where has this foolish count gone to meet me?" asked Rudolf lightly.
"You haven't seen him?"
"No, I came straight from the castle of Zenda."
"But," she cried, "he expected to find you at the hunting lodge." "Ah, but now I recollect the Count of Rischenheim was greatly vexed to find on his return that his cousin was gone."
"Ah, he was gone. Now I see. Rischenheim brought a message from me to Count Rupert."
"And they missed one another, Your Majesty."
"Exactly, my dear young lady. Very vexatious it is, upon my word. In this remark, at least, Rudolf spoke no more and no other than he felt. "But when do you expect the Count of Hentzau?" he pursued.
"Early in the morning, your Majesty, at 7 or 8.
Rudolf came nearer to her and took a couple of gold coins from his pocket.
"I don't want money, your Majesty," she murmured.
"Oh, make a hole in them and hang them round your neck."
"Ah, yes, yes, give them to me," she cried, holding out her hand eagerly.
"You'll earn them?" he asked, playfully holding them out of her reach.
"How?"
"By being ready to open to me when I come at 11 and knock as Bauer knocked."
"Yes, I'll be there."
"And by telling nobody that I've been here tonight. Will you promise me that?"
"Not my mother?"
"No."
"Nor the Count of Lutzau-Rischenheim?"
"Him least of all. You must tell nobody. My business is very private, and Rischenheim doesn't know it."
"I'll do all you tell me, but Bauer knows."
"True," said Rudolf. "Bauer knows. Well, we'll see about Bauer." As he spoke, he turned towards the door. Suddenly the girl bent, snatched at his hand, and kissed it.
"I would die for you," she murmured.
"Poor child," said he gently. I believe he was loath to make profit, even in the Queen's service, of her poor, foolish love. He laid his hand on the door, but paused a moment to say, "If Bauer comes, you have told me nothing. Mind, nothing. I threatened you, but you told me nothing."
"He'll tell them you have been here."
"That can't be helped. At least they won't know when I shall arrive again. Good night." Rudolf opened the door and slipped through, closing it hastily behind him. If Bauer got back to the house, his visit must be known. But if he could intercept Bauer, the girl's silence was assured. He stood just outside, listening intently and searching the darkness with eager eyes. End of chapter 10. Chapter 11 of Rupert of Hentzau. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please go to LibriVox.org. Recording by Andy Minter. Rupert of Hentzau. Taken from the memoirs of Fritz von Tarlenheim. By Anthony Hope. Chapter 11. What the Chancellor's Wife Saw. The night, so precious in its silence, solitude, and darkness, was waning fast. Soon the first dim approaches of day would be visible. Soon the streets would become alive, and people be about. Before then, Rudolf Rassendyll, the man who bore a face that he dared not show in open day, must be under cover. Else men would say that the king was in Strelsau, and the news would flash in a few hours through the kingdom, and, so Rudolf feared, reach even those ears which we knew to be shut to all earthly sounds. But there was still some time at Mr. Rassendyll's disposal, and he could not spend it better than in pursuing his fight with Bauer. Taking a leaf out of the rascal's own book, he drew himself back into the shadow of the house walls and prepared to wait. At the worst, he could keep the fellow from communicating with Rischenheim for a little longer, but his hope was that Bauer would steal back after a while and reconnoitre with a view to discovering how matters stood, whether the unwelcome visitor had taken his departure and the way to Rischenheim were open. Wrapping his scarf closely round his face, Rudolf waited, patiently enduring the tedium as he best might, drenched by the rain, which fell steadily, and very imperfectly sheltered from the buffeting of the wind. Minutes went by. There were no signs of Bauer, nor of anybody else in the silent street. Yet Rudolf did not venture to leave his post. Bauer would seize the opportunity to slip in. Perhaps Bauer had seen him come out, and was in his turn waiting till the coast should be clear. Or again, perhaps the useful spy had gone off to intercept Rupert of Hentzau, and warn him of the danger in the Königstrasse. Ignorant of the truth, and compelled to accept all these chances, Rudolf waited, still watching the distant beginnings of dawning day, which must soon drive him to his hiding-place again. Meanwhile, my poor wife waited also, a prey to every fear that a woman's sensitive mind can imagine and feed upon. Rudolf turned his head this way and that, seeking always the darker blot of shadow that would mean a human being. For a while his search was vain, but presently he found what he looked for, aye, and even more. On the same side of the street, to his left hand from the direction of the station, not one, but three blurred shapes moved up the street. They came stealthily, yet quickly, with caution, but without pause or hesitation. Rudolf, scenting danger, flattened himself close against the wall and felt for his revolver. Very likely they were only early workers or late revellers, but he was ready for something else. He had not yet sighted Bauer, and action was to be looked for from the man. By infinitely gradual sidelong slitherings, he moved a few paces from the door of Mother Holf's house, and stood 6 feet, perhaps, or eight, on the right-hand side of it. The three came on. He strained his eyes in the effort to discern their features. In that dim light certainty was impossible, but the one in the middle might well be Bauer. The height, the walk, and the make were much what Bauer's were. If it were Bauer, then Bauer had friends, and Bauer and his friends seemed to be stalking some game. Always most carefully and gradually, Rudolf edged yet further from the little shop. At a distance of some 5 yards, he halted finally, drew out his revolver, covered the man whom he took to be Bauer, and thus waited his fortune and his chance. Now it was plain that Bauer, for Bauer it was, would look for one of two things. What he hoped was to find Rudolf still in the house. What he feared was to be told that Rudolf, having fulfilled the unknown purpose of his visit, was gone whole and sound. If the latter tidings met him, these two good friends of his, whom he had enlisted for reinforcement, were to have 5 crowns each, and go home in peace. If the former, they were to do their work, and make 10 crowns. Years after, one of them told me the whole story, without shame or reserve. What their work was, the heavy bludgeons they carried, and the long knife that one of them had lent to Bauer, showed pretty clearly. But neither to Bauer nor to them did it occur that their quarry might be crouching near, hunting as well as hunted. Not that the pair of ruffians who had been thus hired would have hesitated for that thought, as I imagine. For it is strange, yet certain, that the zenith of courage and the acme of villainy can alike be bought for the price of a lady's glove. Among such outcasts as those from whom Bauer drew his recruits, the murder of a man is held serious only when the police are by, and death at the hands of him they seek to kill is no more than an everyday risk of their employment.
"Here's the house," whispered Bauer, stopping at the door. "Now, I'll knock, and you stand by to knock him on the head if he runs out. He's got a six-shooter, so I'll lose no time."
"He'll only fire it in heaven," growled a hoarse, guttural voice that ended in a chuckle.
"But if he's gone," objected the other auxiliary.
"Then I know where he's gone,"
answered Bauer.
A ruffian stood on either side of the door with uplifted bludgeon. Bauer raised his hand to knock. Rudolf knew that Rischenheim was within, and he feared that Bauer, hearing that the stranger had gone, would take the opportunity of telling the Count of his visit. The Count would, in his turn, warn Rupert of Hentzau, and the work of catching the ringleader would all fall to be done again. At no time did Mr. Rassendyll take count of odds against him, but in this instance he may well have thought himself, with his revolver, a match for the three ruffians. At any rate, before Bauer had time to give the signal, he sprang out suddenly from the wall and darted at the fellow. His onset was so sudden that the other two fell back a pace. Rudolf caught Bauer fairly by the throat. I do not suppose that he meant to strangle him, but the anger, long stored in his heart, found vent in the fierce grip of his fingers. It is certain that Bauer thought his time was come unless he struck a blow for himself. Instantly he raised his hand and thrust fiercely at Rudolf with his long knife. Mr. Rassendyll would have been a dead man had he not loosed his hold and sprung lightly away. But Bauer sprang at him again, thrusting with the knife, and crying to his associates, "Club him, you fools, club him!" Thus exhorted, one jumped forward. The moment for hesitation had gone. In spite of the noise of wind and pelting rain, the sound of a shot risked much. But not to fire was death. Rudolf fired, full at Bauer. The fellow saw his intention and tried to leap behind one of his companions. He was just too late and fell with a groan to the ground. Again the other ruffians shrank back, appalled by the sudden ruthless decision of the act. Mr. Rassendyll laughed. A half-smothered, yet uncontrolled oath broke from one of them. "By God!" he whispered hoarsely, gazing at Rudolf's face and letting his arm fall to his side. "My God!" he said then, and his mouth hung open. Again Rudolf laughed at his terrified stare. "A bigger job than you fancied, is it?" he asked, pushing his scarf well away from his chin. The man gaped at him. The other's eyes asked wondering questions, but neither did he attempt to resume the attack. The first at last found voice, and he said, "Well, it'll be damned cheap at 10 crowns, and that's the living truth." His friend, or confederate rather, for such men have no friends, looked on, still amazed. "Take up that fellow by his head and his heels," ordered Rudolf. "Quickly, I suppose you don't want the police to find us here with him, do you? Well, no more do I. Lift him up." As he spoke, Rudolf turned to knock at the door of number 19. But even as he did so, Bauer groaned. Dead, perhaps he ought to have been, but it seems to me that fate is always ready to take the cream and leave the scum. His leap aside had served him well, after all. He had nearly escaped scot-free. As it was, the bullet, almost missing his head altogether, had just glanced on his temple as it passed. Its impact had stunned, but not killed. Friend Bauer was in unusual luck that night. I wouldn't have taken 100 to 1 about his chance of life. Rudolf arrested his hand. It would not do to leave Bauer at the house if Bauer were likely to regain speech. He stood for a moment, considering what to do, but in an instant the thoughts that he tried to gather were scattered again. "The patrol! The patrol!" hoarsely whispered the fellow, who had not yet spoken. There was a sound of the hoofs of horses. Down the street from the station end there appeared 2 mounted men. Without a second moment's hesitation, the 2 rascals dropped their friend Bauer with a thud on the ground. One ran at his full speed across the street, the other bolted no less quickly up the Königstrasse. Neither could afford to meet the constables, and who could say what story this red-haired gentleman might tell, aye, or what powers he might command? But in truth, Rudolf gave no thought to either his story or his powers. If he were caught, the best he could hope would be to lie in the lock-up while Rupert played his game unmolested. The device that he had employed against the amazed ruffians could be used against lawful authority only as a last and desperate resort. While he could run, run he would. In an instant he also took to his heels, following the fellow who had darted up the Königstrasse, but before he had gone very far, coming to a narrow turning, he shot down it. Then he paused for a moment to listen. The patrol had seen the sudden dispersal of the group, and struck with natural suspicion, quickened pace. A few minutes brought them to where Bauer was. They jumped from their horses and ran to him. He was unconscious, and could, of course, give them no account of how he came to be in his present state. The fronts of all the houses were dark, the doors shut. There was nothing to connect the man stretched on the ground with either number 19 or any other dwelling. Moreover, the constables were not sure that the sufferer was himself a meritorious object, for his hand still held a long, ugly knife. They were perplexed. They were but 2. There was a wounded man to look after. There were 3 men to pursue, and the 3 had fled in 3 separate directions. They looked up at number 19. Number 19 remained dark, quiet, absolutely indifferent. The fugitives were out of sight. Rudolf Rassendyll, hearing nothing, had started again on his way. But a minute later he heard a shrill whistle. The patrol were summoning assistance. The man must be carried to the station, and a report made. But other constables might be warned of what had happened, and dispatched in pursuit of the culprits. Rudolf heard more than one answering whistle. He broke into a run, looking for a turning on the left that would take him back in the direction of my house, but he found none. The narrow street twisted and curved in the bewildering way that characterizes the old parts of the town. Rudolf had spent some time once in Strelsau, but a king learns little of back streets, and he was soon fairly puzzled as to his whereabouts. Day was dawning, and he began to meet people here and there. He dared run no more, even had his breath lasted him. Winding the scarf about his face, and cramming his hat over his forehead again, he fell into an easy walk, wondering whether he could venture to ask his way. Relieved to find no signs that he was being pursued, trying to persuade himself that Bauer, though not dead, was at least incapable of embarrassing disclosures. Above all, conscious of the danger of his telltale face, and of the necessity of finding some shelter before the city was all stirring and awake. At this moment he heard horses' hoofs behind him. He was now at the end of the street, where it opened on the square in which the barracks stand. He knew his bearings now, and had he not been interrupted, could have been back to safe shelter in my house in 20 minutes. But, looking back, he saw the figure of a mounted constable just coming into sight behind him. The man seemed to see Rudolf, for he broke into a quick trot. Mr. Rassendyll's position was critical. This fact alone accounts for the dangerous step into which he allowed himself to be forced. Here he was, a man unable to give account of himself, of remarkable appearance, and carrying a revolver, of which one barrel was discharged. And there was Bauer, a wounded man, shot by somebody with a revolver, a quarter of an hour before. Even to be questioned was dangerous. To be detained meant ruin to the great business that engaged his energies. For all he knew, the patrol had actually sighted him as he ran. His fears were not vain, for the constable raised his voice, crying, "Hi, sir, you there, stop a minute!" Resistance was the one thing worse than to yield. Wit and not force must find escape this time. Rudolf stopped, looking round again with a surprised air. Then he drew himself up with an assumption of dignity, and waited for the constable. If that last card must be played, he would win the hand with it. "Well, what do you want?" he asked coldly, when the man was a few yards from him, and as he spoke he withdrew the scarf almost entirely from his features, keeping it only over his chin. "You call very peremptorily," he continued, staring contemptuously. "What's your business with me?" With a violent start, the sergeant, for such the star on his collar and the lace on his cuff proclaimed him, leant forward in the saddle to look at the man whom he had hailed. Rudolf said nothing, and did not move. The man's eyes studied his face intently. Then he sat bolt upright and saluted. His face dyed to a deep red in his sudden confusion. "And why do you salute me now?" asked Rudolf in a mocking tone. "First you hunt me, then you salute me. By heaven, I don't know why you put yourself out at all about me." "The fellow stuttered. Then, trying a fresh start, he stammered, "Your Majesty, I didn't know, I didn't suppose—" Rudolf stepped towards him with a quick, decisive tread. "And why do you call me Your Majesty?" he asked, still mockingly. "Isn't it Your Majesty?" Rudolf was close by him now, his hand on the horse's neck. He looked up into the sergeant's face with steady eyes, saying, "You make a mistake, my friend. I am not the king." "You are not?" stuttered the bewildered fellow. "By no means. And, Sergeant?" "Your Majesty?" "Sir, you mean?" "Yes, sir." "A zealous officer, Sergeant, can make no greater mistake than to take for the king a gentleman who is not the king. It might injure his prospects, since the king, not being here, mightn't wish to have it supposed that he was here. Do you follow me, Sergeant?" The man said nothing, but stared hard. After a moment, Rudolf continued. "In such a case," said he, "a discreet officer would not trouble the gentleman any more, and would be very careful not to mention that he had made such a silly mistake. Indeed, if questioned, he would answer without hesitation that he hadn't seen anybody even like the king, much less the king himself." A doubtful, puzzled little smile spread under the sergeant's moustache. "You see, the king is not even in Strelsau," said Rudolf. "Not in Strelsau, sir? Why, no,"
"He's at Zenda." "Ah, Zenda, sir." "Certainly. It is therefore impossible, physically impossible, that he should be here." The fellow was convinced that he understood now.
"It's certainly impossible, sir," said he, smiling more broadly. "Absolutely. And therefore impossible also that you should have seen him."
With this, Rudolf took a gold piece from his pocket and handed it to the sergeant. The fellow took it with something like a wink.
"As for you, you've searched here and found nobody," concluded Mr. Rassendyll. "So hadn't you better at once search somewhere else?"
"Without doubt, sir," said the sergeant, and with the most deferential salute and another confidential smile, he turned and rode back the way he had come. No doubt he wished that he could meet a gentleman who was not the king every morning of his life. It hardly need be said that all idea of connecting the gentleman with the crime committed in the Königstrasse had vanished from his mind. Thus Rudolf won freedom from the man's interference, but at a dangerous cost. How dangerous he did not know. It was indeed most impossible that the king could be in Strelsau. He lost no time now in turning his steps towards his refuge. It was past 5 o'clock. Day came quickly, and the streets began to be peopled by men and women on their way to open stalls or buy in the market. Rudolf crossed the square at a rapid walk, for he was afraid of the soldiers who were gathering for early duty opposite to the barracks. Fortunately, he passed by them unobserved, and gained the comparative seclusion of the street in which my house stands, without encountering any further difficulties. In truth, he was almost in safety, but bad luck was now to have its turn. When Mr. Rassendyll was no more than 50 yards from my door, a carriage suddenly drove up and stopped a few paces in front of him. The footman sprang down and opened the door. Two ladies got out. They were dressed in evening costume and were returning from a ball. One was middle-aged, the other young and rather pretty. They stood for a moment on the pavement, the younger saying, "Isn't it pleasant, mother? I wish I could always be up at 5 o'clock." "My dear, you wouldn't like it for long," answered the elder. "It's very nice for a change, but—" She stopped abruptly. Her eye had fallen on Rudolf Rassendyll. He knew her. She was no less a person than the wife of Helsing, the Chancellor. His was the house at which the carriage had stopped. The trick that had served with the sergeant of police would not do now. She knew the king too well to believe that she could be mistaken about him. She was too much of a busybody to be content to pretend that she was mistaken. "Good gracious!" she whispered loudly, and catching her daughter's arm, she murmured, "Heavens, my dear, it's the king!" Rudolf was caught. Not only the ladies, but their servants were looking at him. Flight was impossible. He walked by them. The ladies curtsied. The servants bowed bareheaded. Rudolf touched his hat and bowed slightly in return. He walked straight on towards my house. They were watching him, and he knew it. Most heartily did he curse the untimely hours to which folks keep up their dancing, but he thought that a visit to my house would afford as plausible an excuse for his presence as any other. So he went on, surveyed by the wondering ladies and by the servants who, smothering smiles, asked one another what brought His Majesty abroad in such a plight, for Rudolf's clothes were soaked and his boots muddy at such an hour, and that in Strelsau, when all the world thought he was at Zenda. Rudolf reached my house. Knowing that he was watched, he had abandoned all intention of giving the signal agreed on between my wife and himself, and of making his way in through the window. Such a sight would indeed have given the excellent Baroness von Helsing matter for gossip. It was better to let every servant in my house see his open entrance. But, alas, virtue itself sometimes leads to ruin. My dearest Helga, sleepless and watchful in the interest of her mistress, was even now behind the shutter, listening with all her ears and peering through the chinks. No sooner Rudolf's footsteps became audible than she cautiously unfastened the shutter, opened the window, put her pretty head out, and called softly, "All safe? Come in!" The mischief was done then, for the faces of Helsing's wife and daughter, aye, and the faces of Helsing's servants, were intent on this most strange spectacle. Rudolf, turning his head over his shoulder, saw them. A moment later poor Helga saw them also. Innocent and untrained in controlling her feelings, she gave a shrill little cry of dismay and hastily drew back. Rudolf looked round again. The ladies had retreated to the cover of the porch, but he still saw their eager faces peering from between the pillars that supported it. "I may as well go in now," said Rudolf, and in he sprang. There was a merry smile on his face as he ran forward to meet Helga, who leant against the table, paled and agitated. "They saw you?" she gasped. "Undoubtedly," said he. Then his sense of amusement conquered everything else, and he sat down in a chair laughing. "I'd give my life," said he, "to hear the story that the Chancellor will be waked up to hear in a minute or two from now." But a moment's thought made him grave again. For whether he were the king or Rudolf Rassendyll, he knew that my wife's name was in equal peril. Knowing this, he stood at nothing to serve her. He turned to her and spoke quickly. "You must rouse one of the servants at once. Send him round to the Chancellor's and tell the Chancellor to come here directly. No, write a note. Say the king has come by appointment to see Fritz on some private business, but that Fritz has not kept the appointment, and that the king must now see the Chancellor at once. Say there's not a moment to lose." She was looking at him with wondering eyes. "Don't you see," he said, "if I can impose on Helsing, I may stop those women's tongues. If nothing's done, how long do you suppose it'll be before all Strelsau knows that Fritz von Tarlenheim's wife let the king in the window at 5 o'clock in the morning?" "I don't understand," murmured poor Helga in bewilderment. "No, my dear lady, but for heaven's sake do what I ask of you. It's the only chance now." "I'll do it," she said, and sat down to write. Thus it was that hard on the marvellous tidings, which, as I conjecture, the Baroness von Helsing poured into her husband's drowsy ears, came an imperative summons that the Chancellor should wait on the king at the house of Fritz von Tarlenheim. Truly we had tempted fate too far by bringing Rudolf Rassendyll again to Strelsau. End of chapter 11. Chapter 12 of Rupert of Hentzau. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please go to LibriVox.org. Recording by Andy Minter. Rupert of Hentzau. Taken from the memoirs of Fritz von Tarlenheim. By Anthony Hope. Chapter 12. Before Them All. Great as was the risk, and immense as were the difficulties created by the course which Mr. Rassendyll adopted, I cannot doubt that he acted for the best in the light of the information which he possessed. His plan was to disclose himself in the character of the king to Helsing, to bind him to secrecy, and make him impose the same obligation on his wife, daughter, and servants. The Chancellor was to be quieted with the excuse of urgent business, and conciliated by a promise that he should know its nature in the course of a few hours. Meanwhile, an appeal to his loyalty must suffice to ensure obedience. If all went well in the day that had now dawned, by the evening of it the letter would be destroyed, the Queen's peril past, and Rudolf once more far away from Strelsau. Then enough of the truth, no more, must be disclosed. Helsing would be told the story of Rudolf Rassendyll, and persuaded to hold his tongue about the harum scarum Englishman. We are ready to believe much of an Englishman, having been audacious enough again to play the king in Strelsau. The old Chancellor was a very good fellow, and I do not think that Rudolf did wrong in relying upon him. Where he miscalculated was, of course, just where he was ignorant. The whole of what the Queen's friends, aye, and the Queen herself, did in Strelsau, became useless and mischievous by reason of the King's death. Their action must have been utterly different had they been aware of that catastrophe, but their wisdom must be judged only according to their knowledge. In the first place, the Chancellor himself showed much good sense. Even before he obeyed the King's summons, he sent for the two servants and charged them, on pain of instant dismissal and worse things to follow, to say nothing of what they had seen.
His commands to his wife and daughter were more polite, doubtless, but no less peremptory. He may well have supposed that the king's business was private as well as important, when it led his majesty to be roaming the streets of Strelsau at a moment when he was supposed to be at the castle of Zenda, and to enter a friend's house by the window at such untimely hours. The mere facts were eloquent of secrecy. Moreover, the king had shaved his beard. The ladies were sure of it, and this again, though it might be merely an accidental coincidence, was also capable of signifying a very urgent desire to be unknown. So the Chancellor, having given his orders and being himself aflame with the liveliest curiosity, lost no time in obeying the king's commands, and arrived at my house before 6 o'clock. When the visitor was announced, Rudolf was upstairs, having a bath and some breakfast. Helga had learnt her lesson well enough to entertain the visitor until Rudolf appeared. She was full of apologies for my absence, protesting that she could in no way explain it. Neither could she so much as conjecture what was the king's business with her husband. She played the dutiful wife, whose virtue was obedience, whose greatest sin would be an indiscreet prying into what it was not her part to know. "I know no more," she said, "than that Fritz wrote to me to expect the king and him at about 5 o'clock, and to be ready to let them in by the window, as the king did not wish the servants to be aware of his presence." The king came and greeted Helsing most graciously. The tragedy and comedy of those busy days were strangely mingled. Even now I can hardly help smiling when I picture Rudolf with grave lips, but that distant twinkle in his eye. I swear he enjoyed the sport, sitting down by the old Chancellor in the darkest corner of the room, covering him with flattery, hinting at most strange things, deploring a secret obstacle to immediate confidence, promising that tomorrow at the latest he would seek the advice of the wisest and most tried of his councillors, appealing to the Chancellor's loyalty to trust him till then. Helsing, blinking through his spectacles, followed with devout attention the long narrative that told nothing, and the urgent exhortation that masked a trick. His accents were almost broken with emotion as he put himself absolutely at the king's disposal, and declared that he could answer for the discretion of his family and household as completely as for his own. "Then you're a very lucky man, my dear Chancellor," said Rudolf, with a sigh that seemed to hint that the king in his palace was not so fortunate. Helsing was immensely pleased. He was all agog to go and tell his wife how entirely the king trusted to her honour and silence. There was nothing that Rudolf more desired than to be relieved of the excellent old fellow's presence, but well aware of the supreme importance of keeping him in a good temper, he would not hear of his departure for a few minutes. "At any rate, the ladies won't talk till after breakfast, and since they got home only at 5 o'clock, they won't breakfast yet a while," said he. So he made Helsing sit down and talk to him. Rudolf had not failed to notice that the Count of Lutzau-Rischenheim had been a little surprised at the sound of his voice. In this conversation he studiously kept his tones low, affecting a certain weakness and huskiness, such as he had detected in the king's utterance, as he listened behind the curtain in Sapt's room at the castle. The part was played as completely and triumphantly as in the old days, when he ran the gauntlet of every eye in Strelsau. Yet if he had not taken such pains to conciliate old Helsing, but had let him depart, he might not have found himself driven to a greater and even more hazardous deception. They were conversing together alone. My wife had been prevailed on by Rudolf to lie down in her room for an hour. Sorely needing rest, she had obeyed him, having first given strict orders that no member of the household should enter the room where the two were, except on an express summons. Fearing suspicion, she and Rudolf had agreed that it was better to rely on these injunctions than to lock the door again as they had the night before. But while these things passed at my house, the Queen and Bernenstein were on their way to Strelsau. Perhaps, had Sapt been at Zenda, his powerful influence might have availed to check the impulsive expedition. Bernenstein had no such authority, and could only obey the Queen's peremptory orders and pathetic prayers. Ever since Rudolf Rassendyll left her, 3 years before, she had lived in stern self-repression, never her true self, never for a moment able to be or to do what at every hour her heart urged on her. How are these things done? I doubt if a man lives who could do them.
but women live who do them. Now his sudden coming, and the train of stirring events that accompanied it, his danger and hers, his words and her enjoyment of his presence, had all worked together to shatter her self-control. And the strange dream, heightening the emotion which was its own cause, left her with no conscious desire save to be near Mr. Rassendyll, and scarcely with a fear except for his safety. As they journeyed, her talk was all of his peril, never of the disaster which threatened herself, and which we were all striving with might and main to avert from her head. She travelled alone with Bernenstein, getting rid of the lady who attended her by some careless pretext, and she urged on him continually to bring her as speedily as might be to Mr. Rassendyll. I cannot find much blame for her. Rudolf stood for all the joy in her life, and Rudolf had gone to fight with the Count of Hentzau. What wonder that she saw him, as it were, dead? Yet still she would have it that in his seeming death all men hailed him for their king. Well, it was her love that crowned him. As they reached the city, she grew more composed, being persuaded by Bernenstein that nothing in her bearing must rouse suspicion. Yet she was none the less resolved to seek Mr. Rassendyll at once. In truth, she feared even then to find him dead, so strong was the hold of her dream on her. Until she knew that he was alive, she could not rest. Bernenstein, fearful that the strain would kill her or rob her of reason, promised everything, and declared, with a confidence which he did not feel, that beyond doubt Mr. Rassendyll was alive and well. "But where? Where?" she cried eagerly, with clasped hands. "We are most likely, madam, to find him at Fritz von Tarlenheim's," answered the lieutenant. "He would wait there till the time came to attack Rupert, or, if the thing is over, he will have returned there." "Then let us drive there at once," she urged. Bernenstein, however, persuaded her to go to the palace first, and let it be known there that she was going to pay a visit to my wife. She arrived at the palace at 8 o'clock, took a cup of chocolate, and then ordered her carriage. Bernenstein alone accompanied her when she set out for my house about 9. He was, by now, hardly less agitated than the Queen herself. In her entire preoccupation with Mr. Rassendyll, she gave little thought to what might have happened at the hunting lodge, but Bernenstein drew gloomy auguries from the failure of Sapt and myself to return at the proper time. Either evil had befallen us, or the letter had reached the King before we arrived at the lodge. The probabilities seemed to him to be confined to these alternatives. Yet, when he spoke in this strain to the Queen, he could get from her nothing except, "If we can find Mr. Rassendyll, he will tell us what to do." Thus, then, a little after 9 in the morning, the Queen's carriage drove up to my door. The ladies of the Chancellor's family had enjoyed a very short night's rest, for their heads came bobbing out of the window the moment the wheels were heard. Many people were about now, and the crown on the panels attracted the usual small crowd of loiterers. Bernenstein sprang out and gave his hand to the Queen. With a hasty slight bow to the onlookers, she hastened up the 2 or 3 steps of the porch, and with her own hand rang the bell. Inside, the carriage had just been observed. My wife's waiting-maid ran hastily to her mistress. Helga was lying on her bed. She rose at once, and after a few moments of necessary preparations, or such preparations as seem to ladies necessary, however great the need of haste may be, hurried downstairs to receive Her Majesty, and to warn Her Majesty. She was too late. The door was already open. The butler and the footman had both run to it, and thrown it open for the Queen. As Helga reached the foot of the stairs, Her Majesty was just entering the room where Rudolf was, the servants attending her, and Bernenstein standing behind, his helmet in his hand. Rudolf and the Chancellor had been continuing their conversation. To avoid the observation of passers-by, for the interior of the room is easy to see from the street, the blind had been drawn down, and the room was in deep shadow. They had heard the wheels, but neither of them dreamt that the visitor could be the Queen. It was an utter surprise to them when, without their orders, the door was suddenly flung open. The Chancellor, slow of movement, and not, if I may say it, over quick of brain, sat in his corner for half a minute or more before he rose to his feet. On the other hand, Rudolf Rassendyll was the best part of the way across the room in an instant. Helga was at the door now, and she thrust her head round young Bernenstein's broad shoulders. Thus she saw what happened. The Queen, forgetting the servant and not observing Helsing, seeming indeed to stay for nothing and to think of nothing but to have her thoughts and her heart filled with the sight of the man she loved and the knowledge of his safety, met him as he ran towards her, and before Helga or Bernenstein or Rudolf himself could stay her or conceive what she was about to do, caught both his hands in hers with an intense grasp, crying, "Rudolf, you're safe! Thank God! Oh, thank God!" And she carried his hands to her lips and kissed them passionately. A moment of absolute silence followed, dictated in the servants by decorum, in the Chancellor by consideration, in Helga and Bernenstein by utter consternation. Rudolf himself also was silent, but whether from bewilderment or an emotion answering to hers, I know not. Either it might well be. The stillness struck her. She looked up in his eyes, she looked round the room, and saw Helsing, now bowing profoundly from the corner. She turned her head with a sudden frightened jerk, and glanced at my motionless deferential servants. Then it came upon her what she had done. She gave a quick gasp for breath, and her face, always pale, went white as marble. Her features set in a strange stiffness, and suddenly she reeled where she stood and fell forward. Only Rudolf's hand bore her up. Thus, for a moment, too short to reckon, they stood. Then he, a smile of great love and pity coming on his lips, drew her to him, and, passing his arm around her waist, thus supported her. Then, smiling still, he looked down on her, and said in a low tone, yet distinct enough for all to hear, "All is well, dearest." My wife gripped Bernenstein's arm, and he turned to find her, pale-faced too, with quivering lips and shining eyes. But the eyes had a message, and an urgent one for him. He read it. He knew that it bade him second what Rudolf Rassendyll had done. He came forward and approached Rudolf. Then he fell on one knee and kissed Rudolf's left hand that was extended to him. "I am very glad to see you, Lieutenant von Bernenstein," said Rudolf Rassendyll. For a moment the thing was done, ruin averted and safety secured. Everything had been at stake. That there was such a man as Rudolf Rassendyll might have been disclosed. That he had once filled the king's throne was a high secret, which they were prepared to trust to Helsing under stress of necessity. But there remained something which must be hidden at all costs, and which the Queen's passionate exclamation had threatened to expose. There was a Rudolf Rassendyll, and he had been king. But more than all this, the Queen loved him, and he the Queen. That could be told to none, not even to Helsing, for Helsing, though he would not gossip in the town, would yet hold himself bound to carry the matter to the king. So Rudolf chose to take any future difficulties, rather than that present and certain disaster. Sooner than entail it on her he loved, he claimed for himself the place of her husband and the name of the king. And she, clutching at the only chance that her act left, was content to have it so. It may be that for an instant her weary, tortured brain found sweet rest in the dim dream that it was so, for she let her head lie there on his breast, and her eyes closed, her face looking very peaceful, and a soft little sigh escaping in pleasure from her lips. But every moment bore its peril, and exacted its effort. Rudolf led the Queen to a couch, and then briefly charged the servants not to speak of his presence for a few hours. As they had no doubt perceived, said he, from the Queen's agitation, important business was on foot. It demanded his presence in Strelsau, but required also that his presence should not be known. A short time would free them from the obligation which he now asked of their loyalty. When they had withdrawn, bowing obedience, he turned to Helsing, pressed his hand warmly, reiterated his quest for silence, and said that he would summon the Chancellor to his presence again later in the day, either where he was or at the palace. Then he bade all withdraw, and leave him alone for a little with the Queen. He was obeyed, but Helsing had hardly left the house when Rudolf called Bernenstein back, and with him my wife. Helga hastened to the Queen, who was still sorely agitated. Rudolf drew Bernenstein aside, and exchanged with him all their news. Mr. Rassendyll was much disturbed at finding that no tidings had come from Colonel Sapt and myself, but his apprehension was greatly increased on learning the untoward accident by which the king himself had been at the lodge the night before. Indeed, he was utterly in the dark. Where the king was, where Rupert, where we were, he did not know, and he was here in Strelsau, known as the king to half a dozen people or more, protected only by their promises, liable at any moment to be exposed by the coming of the king himself, or even by a message from him. Yet, in face of all perplexities, perhaps even the more because of the darkness in which he was enveloped, Rudolf held firm to his purpose. There were two things that seemed plain. If Rupert had escaped the trap and was still alive with the letter on him, Rupert must be found. Here was the first task. That accomplished, there remained for Rudolf himself nothing save to disappear as quietly and secretly as he had come, trusting that his presence could be concealed from the man whose name he had usurped. Nay, if need were, the king must be told that Rudolf Rassendyll had played a trick on the Chancellor, and having enjoyed his pleasure was gone again. Everything could, in the last resort, be told, save that which touched the Queen's honour. At this moment the message which I dispatched from the station at Hofbau reached my house. There was a knock at the door. Bernenstein opened it and took the telegram which was addressed to my wife. I had written all that I dared to trust to such a means of communication, and here it is. I am coming to Strelsau. The king will not leave the lodge today. The count came, but left before we arrived. I do not know whether he has gone to Strelsau. He gave no news to the king. Then they didn't get him, cried Bernenstein in deep disappointment. No, but he gave no news to the king, said Rudolf triumphantly. They were all standing now round the queen, who sat on the couch. She seemed very faint and weary, but at peace. It was enough for her that Rudolf fought and planned for her. And see this, Rudolf went on, the king will not leave the lodge today. Thank God, then we have today. Yes, but where's Rupert? We shall know in an hour if he's in Strelsau. And Mr. Rassendyll looked as though it would please him well to find Rupert in Strelsau. Yes, I must seek him. I shall stand at nothing to find him. If I can only get to him as the king, then I'll be the king. We have today. My message put them in heart again, although it left so much still unexplained. Rudolf turned to the queen. Courage, my queen, said he. A few hours now will see the end of all our dangers. And then, she asked. Then you'll be safe and at rest, said he, bending over her and speaking softly. And I shall be proud in the knowledge of having saved you. And you? I must go, Helga heard him whisper as he bent lower still, and she and Bernenstein moved away. End of chapter 12. Chapter 13 of Rupert of Hentzau. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please go to LibriVox.org. Recording by Andy Minter. Rupert of Hentzau. Taken from the memoirs of Fritz von Tarlenheim. By Anthony Hope. Chapter 13. A King Up His Sleeve. The tall, handsome girl was taking down the shutters from the shop front at number 19 in the Königstrasse. She went about her work languidly enough, but there was a tinge of dusky red on her cheeks, and her eyes were brightened by some suppressed excitement. Old Mother Holf, leaning against the counter, was grumbling angrily because Bauer did not come. Now it was not likely that Bauer would come just yet, for he was still in the infirmary attached to the police cells, where a couple of doctors were very busy setting him on his legs again. The old woman knew nothing of this, but only that he had gone the night before to reconnoitre. Where he was to play the spy she did not know, on whom perhaps she guessed. "You're sure he never came back?" she asked her daughter. "He never came back that I saw," answered the girl, "and I was on the watch with my lamp here in the shop till it grew light. He's 12 hours gone now, and never a message.
"Oh, and Count Rupert should be here soon, and he'll be in a fine taking if Bauer's not back."
The girl made no answer. She had finished her task and stood in the doorway, looking out on the street. It was past eight, and many people were about. Still, for the most part, humble folk. The more comfortably placed would not be moving for an hour or two yet. In the road, the traffic consisted chiefly of country carts and wagons, bringing in produce for the day's victualling of the great city. The girl watched the stream, but her thoughts were occupied with the stately gentleman who had come to her by night and asked the service of her. She had heard the revolver shot outside. As it sounded, she had blown out her lamp, and there, behind the door in the dark, had heard the swiftly retreating feet of the fugitives, and a little later the arrival of the patrol. Well, the patrol would not dare to touch the king, and as for Bauer, let him be alive or dead, what cared she, who was the king's servant, able to help the king against his enemies? If Bauer were the king's enemy, right glad would she be to hear that the rogue was dead. How finely the king had caught him by the neck and thrown him out. She laughed to think how little her mother knew the company she had kept that night. The row of country carts moved slowly by. One or two stopped before the shop, and the carters offered vegetables for sale. The old woman would have nothing to say to them, but waved them on irritably. Three had thus stopped, and again proceeded, and an impatient grumble broke from the old lady as a fourth, a covered wagon, drew up before the door. "We don't want anything. Go on with you!" she cried shrilly. The carter got down from his seat without heeding her, and walked round to the back. "Here you are, sir," he cried. 19 Königstrasse." A yawn was heard, and the long sigh a man gives as he stretches himself in the mingled luxury and pain of an awakening after a sound, refreshing sleep. "All right, I'll get down," came in answer from inside.
"Oh, it's the Count,"
said the old lady to her daughter in satisfied tones.
"What will he say, though, about that rogue Bauer?"
Rupert of Hentzau put his head out from under the wagon tilt, looked up and down the street, gave the carter a couple of crowns, leapt down and ran lightly across the pavement into the little shop. The wagon moved on.
"A lucky thing I met him," said Rupert cheerily. "The wagon hid me very well, and handsome as my face is, I can't let Strelsau enjoy too much of it just now. Well, mother, what cheer? And you, my pretty, how goes it with you?"
He carelessly brushed the girl's cheek with the glove that he had drawn off.
"Faith, though, I beg your pardon," he added a moment later, "the glove's not clean enough for that."
And he looked at his buff glove, which was stained with patches of dull, rusty brown.
"It's all as when you left, Count Rupert," said Mother Holf, "except that rascal Bauer went out last night."
"That's right enough. But hasn't he returned?"
"No, not yet."
No signs of anybody else?"
His look defined the vague question. The old woman shook her head. The girl turned away to hide a smile. Anybody else meant the king, so she suspected. Well, they should hear nothing from her. The king himself had charged her to be silent.
"But Rischenheim has come, I suppose," pursued Rupert.
"Oh, yes, he came, my lord. Soon after you went. He wears his arm in a sling."
"Ah!" cried Rupert in sudden excitement. "As I guessed, the devil! If only I could do everything myself, and not have to trust to fools and bunglers. Where's the Count?"
"Why, in the attic. You know the way."
"True, but I want some breakfast, mother."
"Rosa shall serve you at once, my lord."
The girl followed Rupert up the narrow, crazy staircase of the tall old house. They passed three floors, all uninhabited, a last steep flight that brought them right under the deep arched roof. Rupert opened a door that stood at the top of the stairs, and, followed still by Rosa with her mysterious happy smile, entered a long, narrow room. The ceiling, high in the centre, sloped rapidly down on either side, so that at door and window it was little more than 6 feet above the floor. There was an oak table and a few chairs. A couple of iron bedsteads stood by the wall near the window. One was empty. The Count of Lutzau-Rischenheim lay on the other,
fully dressed, his right arm supported in a sling of black silk. Rupert paused on the threshold, smiling at his cousin. The girl passed on to a high press or cupboard, and opening it, took out plates, glasses, and the other furniture of the table. Rischenheim sprang up and ran across the room. "What news?" he cried eagerly. "You escaped them, Rupert."
"It appears so," said Rupert airily, and advancing into the room he threw himself into a chair, tossing his hat onto the table. "It appears that I escaped, although some fool's stupidity nearly made an end of me."
Rischenheim flushed.
"I'll tell you about that directly," he said,
glancing at the girl, who had put some cold meat and a bottle of wine on the table, and was now completing the preparations for Rupert's meal in a very leisurely fashion.
"Had I nothing to do but look at pretty faces, which, by heaven, I heartily wish were the case, I would beg you to stay," said Rupert, rising and making her a profound bow.
"I've no wish to hear what doesn't concern me," she retorted scornfully.
"What a rare and blessed disposition," said he, holding the door for her and bowing again.
"I know what I know," she cried to him triumphantly from the landing. "Maybe you'd give something to know it too, Count Rupert."
"It's very likely, for by heaven girls know wonderful things," smiled Rupert. But he shut the door and came back quickly to the table, now frowning again. "Come, tell me, how did they make a fool of you? Or why did you make a fool of me, cousin?"
While Rischenheim related how he had been trapped and tricked at the castle of Zenda, Rupert of Hentzau made a very good breakfast. He offered no interruption and no comments, but when Rudolf Rassendyll came into the story, he looked up for an instant, with a quick jerk of his head and a sudden light in his eyes. The end of Rischenheim's narrative found him tolerant and smiling again.
"Ah, well, the snare was cleverly set," he said. "I don't wonder you fell into it."
"And now you, what happened to you?" asked Rischenheim eagerly.
"I? Why, having your message, which was not your message, I obeyed your directions, which were not your directions."
"You went to the lodge?"
"Certainly."
"And you found Sapt there? Anybody else?"
"Why, not Sapt at all."
"Not Sapt? But surely they laid a trap for you."
"Very possibly, but the jaws didn't bite."
Rupert crossed his legs and lit a cigarette.
"But what did you find?"
I found the king's forester and the king's boar-hound, and, well, I found the king himself, too."
"The king at the lodge?"
"You weren't so wrong as you thought, were you?"
"But surely Sapt or Bernenstein or someone was with him?"
"As I tell you, his forester and his boar-hound. No other man or beast, on my honour."
"Then you gave him the letter?" cried Rischenheim, trembling with excitement.
"Alas, no, my dear cousin. I threw the box at him, but I don't think he had time to open it. We didn't get to that stage of the conversation at which I had intended to produce the letter."
"But why not? Why not?"
Rupert rose to his feet, and coming to just opposite where Rischenheim sat, balanced himself on his heels, and looking down at his cousin, blowing the ash from his cigarette and smiling pleasantly.
"Have you noticed," he asked, "that my coat's torn?"
"I see it is."
"Yes, the boar-hound tried to bite me, cousin, and the forester would have stabbed me. And, well, the king wanted to shoot me."
"Yes, yes, for God's sake, what happened?"
"Well, none of them did what they wanted. That's what happened, dear cousin."
Rischenheim was staring at him now with wide-opened eyes. Rupert smiled down on him composedly.
"Because, you see," he added, "heaven help me, so that, my dear cousin, the dog will bite no more, and the forester will stab no more. Surely the country is well rid of them."
A silence followed. Then Rischenheim, leaning forward, said in a low whisper, as though afraid to hear his own question,
"And the king?"
"The king? Well,
the king will shoot no more."
For a moment Rischenheim, still leaning forward, gazed at his cousin. Then he sank slowly back into his chair.
"My God!"
he murmured.
"My God!"
The king was a fool, said Rupert. Come, I'll tell you a little more about it.
He drew a chair up and seated himself in it. While he talked, Rischenheim seemed hardly to listen. The story gained in effect from the contrast of Rupert's airy telling. His companion's pale face and twitching hands tickled his fancy to more shameless jesting. But when he had finished, he gave a pull to his small, smartly curled moustache, and said, with sudden gravity,
"After all, though, it's a serious matter."
Rischenheim was appalled at the issue. His cousin's influence had been strong enough to lead him into the affair of the letter. He was aghast to think how Rupert's reckless daredevilry had led on from stage to stage till the death of a king seemed but an incident in his schemes. He sprang suddenly to his feet, crying, "But we must fly! We must fly!"
"No, we needn't fly. Perhaps we'd better go, but we needn't fly."
"But when it becomes known..." He broke off and then cried, "Why did you tell me? Why did you come back here?"
"Well, I told you because it was interesting, and I came back here because I had no money to go elsewhere."
"I would have sent money."
"I find that I get more when I ask in person. Besides, is everything finished?"
"I'll have no more to do with it."
"Ah, my dear cousin, you despond too soon. The good king has unhappily gone from us, but we still have our dear queen. We have also, by the kindness of heaven, our dear queen's letter."
"I'll have no more to do with it."
"Your neck feeling..." Rupert delicately imitated the putting of a noose around a man's throat. Rischenheim rose suddenly and flung the window wide open.
"I'm suffocated," he muttered with a sudden frown, avoiding Rupert's eyes.
"Where's Rupert Rassendyll?" asked Rupert. "Have you heard of him?"
"No, I don't know where he is."
"We must find that out, I think."
Rischenheim turned abruptly on him. "I had no hand in this thing," he said, "and I'll have no more to do with it. I was not there. What do I know of the king being there? I'm not guilty of it. On my soul, I know nothing of it."
"That's all very true," nodded Rupert.
"Rupert," cried he, "let me go, let me alone. If you want money, I'll give it to you. For God's sake, take it and get out of Strelsau."
"I'm ashamed to beg, my dear cousin, but in fact I want a little money until I can contrive to realise my valuable property. Is it safe, I wonder? Ah, yes, here it is."
He drew from his inner pocket the Queen's letter.
"Now, if the king hadn't been a fool," he murmured regretfully, as he regarded it.
Then he walked across to the window and looked out. He could not himself be seen from the street, and nobody was visible at the windows opposite. Men and women passed to and fro on their daily labours or pleasures. There was no unusual stir in the city. Looking over the roofs, Rupert could see the royal standard floating in the wind over the palace and the barracks. He took out his watch. Rischenheim imitated his action. It was 10 minutes to 10.
"Rischenheim," he called, "come here a moment. Here, look out."
Rischenheim obeyed, and Rupert let him look for a minute or two before speaking again.
"Do you see anything remarkable?"
he asked then. "No, nothing," asked Rischenheim, still curt and sullen in his fright.
"Well, no more do I. And that's very odd, for don't you think that Sapt or some other of Her Majesty's friends must have gone to the lodge last night?"
"They meant to, I swear," said Rischenheim with sudden attention.
"Then they would have found the king. There's a telegraph wire at Hofbau, only a few miles away, and it's 10 o'clock. My cousin, why isn't Strelsau mourning for our lamented king? Why aren't the flags at half-mast? I don't understand it."
"No," murmured Rischenheim, his eyes now fixed on his cousin's face. Rupert broke into a smile and tapped his teeth with his fingers.
"I wonder," said he meditatively, "if that old player Sapt has got a king up his sleeve again. If that were so..."
He stopped and seemed to fall into deep thought. Rischenheim did not interrupt him, but stood looking now at him, now out of the window. Still there was no stir in the streets, and still the standards floated at the summit of the flagstaffs. The king's death was not yet known in Strelsau. "Where's Bauer?" asked Rupert suddenly. "Where the plague can Bauer be? He was my eyes. Here we are cooped up, and I don't know what's going on."
"I don't know where he is. Something must have happened to him."
"Of course, my wise cousin, but what?" Rupert began to pace up and down the room, smoking another cigarette at a great pace. Rischenheim sat down by the table, resting his head on his hand. He was wearied out by strain and excitement. His wounded arm pained him greatly, and he was full of horror and remorse at the event which had happened unknown to him the night before.
"I wish I was quit of it,"
he moaned at last. Rupert stopped before him.
"You repent of your misdeeds?" he asked. "Well, then, you shall be allowed to repent. Nay, you shall go and tell the king that you repent. Rischenheim, I must know what they are doing. You must go and ask for an audience of the king."
"But the king is..."
"We shall know that better when you've asked for your audience. See here."
Rupert sat down by his cousin and instructed him in his task. This was no other than to discover whether there were a king in Strelsau, or whether the only king lay dead in the hunting lodge. If there were no attempt being made to conceal the king's death, Rupert's plan was to seek safety in flight. He did not abandon his designs. From the secure vantage of foreign soil, he would hold the queen's letter over her head, and by the threat of publishing it, ensure at once immunity for himself, and almost any further terms which he chose to exact from her. If, on the other hand, the Count of Lutzau-Rischenheim found a king in Strelsau, if the royal standards continued to wave at the summit of their flagstaffs, and Strelsau knew nothing of the dead man in the lodge, then Rupert had laid his hand on another secret, for he knew who the king in Strelsau must be. Starting from this point, his audacious mind darted forward to new and bolder schemes. He could offer again to Rudolf Rassendyll what he had offered once before, 3 years ago, a partnership in crime and the profits of crime. Or if this advance were refused, then he declared that he would himself descend openly into the streets of Strelsau and proclaim the death of the king from the steps of the cathedral. "Who can tell?" he cried, springing up, enraptured and merry with the inspiration of his plan. "Who can tell whether Sapt or I came first to the lodge? Who found the king alive, Sapt or I? Who left him dead, Sapt or I? Who has most interest in killing him? I, who only sought to make him aware of what touched his honour, or Sapt, who was and is hand in glove with a man that now robs him of his name and usurps his place while his body is still warm? Ah, they haven't done with Rupert of Hentzau yet." He stopped, looking down on his companion. Rischenheim's fingers still twitched nervously, and his cheeks were pale. But now his face was alight with interest and eagerness. Again the fascination of Rupert's audacity, and the infection of his courage, caught on his kinsman's weaker nature, and inspired him to a temporary emulation of the will that dominated him. "You see," pursued Rupert, "it's not likely that they'll do you any harm."
"I'll risk anything."
"Most gallant gentleman. At the worst, they'll only keep you a prisoner. Well, if you're not back in a couple of hours, I shall draw my conclusions. I shall know that there's a king in Strelsau."
"But where shall I look for the king?"
"Why, first in the palace, and secondly at Fritz von Tarlenheim's. I expect you'll find him at Fritz's, though."
"Shall I go there first, then?"
"No, that would be seeming to know too much."
"You'll wait here?"
"Certainly, cousin, unless I see cause to move, you know."
"And I shall find you here on my return?"
"Me, or directions from me. By the way, bring money too. There's never any harm in having a full pocket. I wonder what the devil does without a breeches pocket."
Rischenheim let that curious speculation alone, although he remembered the whimsical air with which Rupert delivered it. He was now on fire to be gone, his ill-balanced brain leaping from the depths of despondency to the certainty of brilliant success, and not heeding the gulf of danger that it surpassed in buoyant fancy.
"We shall have them in a corner, Rupert," he cried.
"Aye, perhaps. But wild beasts in a corner bite hard."
"I wish my arm were well."
"You'll be safer with it wounded," said Rupert with a smile.
"By God, Rupert, I can defend myself."
"True, true. But it's your brain I want now, cousin."
"You shall see that I have something in me."
"If it please God, dear cousin." With every mocking encouragement and every careless taunt, Rischenheim's resolve to prove himself a man grew stronger. He snatched up a revolver that lay on the mantelpiece and put it in his pocket. "Don't fire if you can help it," advised Rupert. Rischenheim's answer was to make for the door at a great speed. Rupert watched him go, and then returned to the window. The last his cousin saw was his figure standing straight and lithe against the light, while he looked out on the city. Still there was no stir in the streets. Still the royal standard floated at the top of the flagstaffs. Rischenheim plunged down the stairs. His feet were too slow for his eagerness. At the bottom he found the girl Rosa sweeping the passage with great apparent diligence.
"You're going out, my lord?" she asked. "Yes, I have business. Pray stand on one side. This passage is so cursedly narrow."
Rosa's showed no haste in moving.
"And Count Rupert, is he going out also?" she asked.
"You see he's not with me. He'll wait." Rischenheim broke off and asked angrily, "What business is it of yours, girl? Get out of the way."
She moved aside now, making him no answer. He rushed past. She looked after him with a smile of triumph. Then she fell again to her sweeping. The king had bidden her be ready at 11. It was 10:30. Soon the king would have need of her.
End of chapter 13.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.